Ancast is brought to you by RightStuffAnime.com. Check out some great deals on anime, manga, merchandise, figures, and more at RightStuffAnime.com. Disclaimer: the views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in the show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show! Hey everybody, welcome to Ancast. I'm Zach Birchie. Hope is here.
Hello.
And joining us on this very special 2-2 Tuesday for a discussion of the 2003-2004 series?
2002, I think.
2002.
Yeah.
A ways back. Yeah. Junichi Sato made the show. It's called Princess Tutu. Rose Bridges is here. She's one of our writers. You can catch her in our daily streaming reviews, and she is also studying for her PhD in musicology at the University of Texas, so you can understand why we had her on for the show. Rose, thanks for coming on the program.
Hi. I'm really glad to be here.
All right. Very enthusiastic. I'm excited, too. Okay. So I had never seen Princess Tutu before, and the way we always start these things is by talking about kind of how we got into the show. Hope, why don't you start with that?
Yeah, sure. So I first saw Princess Tutu way back in about 2009 when I started, I think it was 2009? Yeah, when I started doing video reviews on YouTube and stuff like that. Like way back, that was just the earliest point at which I had like a couple dozen viewers. It was a really small thing. And that was back when, so I had so few like viewers and stuff like that, that it was actually not that common to get messages with requests for reviews. Later when I was doing this stuff, I would get messages from people like six a day, each with their own giant laundry list of requests, and I could only take requests that people like commissioned, and that was, you know, that's what it eventually grew into. But back at the very beginning, I got a message from somebody, and it was the first, like, viewer request, I really want you to talk about the show thing that I ever got, from someone who was making a very impassioned, like, argument for Princess Tutu and how much I would like it, given my favorite kinds of shows, like Wolf's Rain and Utena and stuff like that. And I was like, okay, well, sure, I'll give it a try. And so I watched it, and it immediately fell in love with it. Originally looking at the art and looking at the premise and stuff like that, I thought it was going to be kind of like a Sailor Moon-y type, I don't know, just maybe not necessarily my thing, maybe skewing a little young or a little simple. And so, but when I started watching it, I was like, oh, this is really like something else. I've never seen anything really like this before. And I thought it was really smart and unique and like entrancing, but also like appropriate for kids. So my little sister, who was like 11 at the time, watched it with me, and she was super into it, and so we got to enjoy it together, and I thought that was really neat, because there wasn't a lot of, she was pretty young, there wasn't a lot of this stuff that I could share with her, but that was definitely one of them. So, that was my experience with the show, and now it's definitely one of my favorite anime.
And, Rose, how did you come to the show?
So I got back into anime a few years ago when a friend recommended Madoka, and I loved that show, and so I was looking for other sort of, subversive magical girl stuff, and somebody recommended Princess Tutu, and I also remember watching Hope's videos and her top 25 anime, and Tutu was near the top, and she also mentioned, like, all the classical music that it used, and I was like, oh, this sounds right up my alley. So I watched it, and it was right up my alley, and it particularly uses a lot of classical music that I'm very attached to and know a lot about. So it sort of got the gears in my head turning, because at the time I was looking for a topic for my master's thesis, and, this seemed like the perfect fit, or at least, you know, using it as a part of a bunch of other, film and TV that used, particular composer's music, in this case, Wagner's music. So I ended up writing a couple of big long papers about Princess Tutu, and it's one of my favorite anime too.
Cool. I heard about the show when it came out because it was kind of a cult thing when it originally released. It was it had, like, you know, stalwart fans who would evangelize for it. Not very many of them. They were very pushy about Princess Tutu. Mostly people balked at the name, which is awful. And they need to.
Anime's got a lot of those.
They should have renamed it. But I actually reviewed the first DVD of Princess Tutu, like, when it came out, however long ago that was. That would have been, like, 2005 or something like that. Something like that. Mm-hmm. At least 10 years ago. I remember liking it, but being kind of, I don't know. The rapturous praise escaped me. I thought it was nice, but it didn't really grab me in the way people were insisting to me that this show was a transcendent experience and that it is one of the all-time greatest animated TV shows ever, and, you know, the usual sort of too much enthusiasm that you get with a cult classic, with something that's considered you know, a cult hit. I never watched past the first DVD. Like I said, it kind of felt like I understand why people really are into this, but for whatever reason, it's not hitting my personal buttons enough to really get me to watch past the first disc. Then, you know, 10 years, I guess, passed. And in those 10 years, the fan fervor for it hasn't really died down. In fact, I think it's only kind of grown its cult audience. And now the show is sort of routinely mentioned in people's, like, all-time top 10 list of anime. You know, that's not uncommon to see it in there. So my first time watching the whole thing start to finish was over the last, like, week in preparation for this. So I guess we should just kind of dig in. I mean, I don't know if this is a spoiler alert or not, but I am obviously not as big a fan of this show as you two are. So I liked it. I thought it was, like, at most, like, a B+. So, but that's not a condemnation. I'm just, it
you're
was fine
at most. So you're saying
at, like, most
the best it could aspire to
is B+. Yes.
That is.
Oh, no.
I thought it's a good show, but it's just Utena Jr. Sorry.
Yeah, Utena is one of the greatest things ever.
Junior is a lot.
Junior version of that is still one of the greatest things.
But I'm an adult.
Right.
And so this, to me, is a B+, because... Anyway, we'll get into that later. Let's... We got to start from the beginning.
Right.
So, Hope, take it from the top. What is the show about? Let's just focus on the first season for now.
Okay. Well, so once upon a time, there was a man who died. And that's how the story starts. And that man was Drosselmeyer, who had the magic power to write stories that would come to life. And eventually people became so scared of him that they decided that he had to die. So they cut off his hands so he couldn't write any more stories, and, you know, he bled out. But with the last bits of blood shooting from his stumps, which is in one episode, they clarify, he wrote that he would continue to write stories as a ghost. And that came true, too. And so the entire story takes place inside the town where he lived, which is now controlled by the stories that he writes. And he's trying to write a continuation to his magnum opus, The Prince and the Raven, which came true. The Prince and the Raven was about, a headstrong, like, valiant prince who defeats an evil raven who eats people's hearts. And the prince has an ever-giving heart, and he, like, loves everyone, and the raven is his opposite because he's... he only takes and he eats people's hearts and demands their affection and takes it from them. And so at the end of his story, after all of these other characters died and bad things happened to them, the prince locked away the raven by splitting his heart into many pieces. And those pieces of his heart locked the raven away. So that part came true, and now the prince is wandering around this magical town with his heart missing, so he has, like, no emotions, he's just sort of an empty doll, and the raven is scheming a way to return to the world, and Drosselmeyer's writing a story about that. And so the heroine of this story is Princess Tutu, who is just sort of a throwaway character in his original book, who's a sort of standard, like, unrequited love princess who, like, helps the prince by giving her heart and giving up her life, and she turns into a little speck of light and vanishes after she confesses her love. And she was sort of a nothing character, but he decides to bring her back, because he can, by transforming a duck, is sort of in the tradition of the Swan Princess, but reverse, transforming a normal, like, seafowl duck into Princess Tutu. And so it's the daily life of Duck, who is the girl that he made out of a literal duck. Her name is just Duck now. And she, as Princess Tutu, regains pieces of the prince's heart. And there's a bunch of other side characters and stuff, but it's just the ongoing adventure of that fairy tale and all the other fairy tales it incorporates. And then the bigger story of Drosselmeyer writing this and kind of, I don't know, combating the characters and what they want versus what he wants them to do.
Right. And so we're introduced to a cast of characters, like the more general narrative, like that's the overall.
Yeah, but
then, that's the backdrop.
So we're talking about the first season. So we got to start on the story of the first season.
Okay, well, the story is mostly just her regaining these heart shards for the prince Mito, who has if you think of like the standard damsel in distress character who just has no character other than waiting for other people to do things for them, that's Prince Mito. He just sort of sits around with this vacant expression on his face and waits for Princess Tutu to help him. And he has there's two people who are sort of the darker shade. Princess Tutu is all hope and light and, oh, I just want to see the prince smile. I want to give him his emotions back so he can be himself again. And then there's these two darker forces that want different things for him. There's a dark princess named Princess Crahee, who is the crow princess. The raven has a daughter, and so that's her. And she wants the prince to love her, because she thinks that nobody in the world can love her except for the prince, who has boundless love to give to everybody. So he can love her, but she wants to have him all for herself, because, you know, she's the raven princess, so that it makes sense. And then the other character is Fakir, who is who is the reincarnation of the knight from the old story. And in the old story, the knight was the prince's companion who was bravely, like, ran into battle and got torn into pieces in order to allow the prince to beat the raven. And he doesn't really do anything other than be, much like Princess Tutu, be a supportive player who gets killed. And as many tragedies have things like that. So Fakir is doesn't want that to happen to himself. So he's trying to stop the story from moving forward. So he's trying to stop... Princess Crahee wants the prince's heart all to herself. And Fakir doesn't want him to get his heart back, because if he gets his heart back, then Fakir will die, and he's scared of that. And so he doesn't want the prince to be in the story either, because the prince could die. So he's also trying to protect the prince, but also trying to protect himself. It's sort of selfless, sort of selfish, all at the same time. So the first season is just these three characters sort of fighting over the prince, and eventually, you know, reaching a conclusion.
Yeah, so that pretty much sums up the first season of this thing, which is split into two seasons with sort of a bizarre formatting thing for the second. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that pretty well sums it up. So I guess, Rose, why don't you talk a little bit about, like, what about the show seemed to be so special to you? Like, what about these characters in this particular situation?
Well, I will say for most of the first season, I was actually pretty underwhelmed. I mean, I really liked the music, but it kind of felt like standard magical girl show. It was around when it started moving up to the finale, and especially the second season, where all those characters get a lot more complicated, that really sort of captured, like, my heart, I guess, for the show, especially what they do with Fakir and Rue, Princess Crahee, in the second season. And make them a lot more sympathetic and give them more complicated roles in the eventual finale.
Okay, well, that's a pretty common criticism of this show, is that it's slow to start and that it doesn't really grab you for a while at the outset. I actually got a lot of feedback from people saying, like, everyone tells me, like, I'm supposed to like this, but I watched, like, five episodes of it and was bored to tears. So when does it get good? And honestly, I thought it got good faster than a lot of people.
I liked it from the beginning.
Said.
But
I certainly didn't. The first episode I thought was like, okay.
On rewatch, I appreciated the beginning.
I really appreciated the tone. I thought, I mean, the music is beautiful. It's a lot of really, like, well-selected. Like, classical music gets slapped into anime and just media in general very thoughtlessly most of the time. And Princess Tutu, just the fact that they were very thoughtful about the choice of pieces and that there's, like, an added layer of meaning to all of them, as well as just they fit the tone even if you don't recognize the piece, is really nice. And, yeah, I even though it's archetypal, I guess the first season's archetypal, like, it's not going to blow your mind with how complex these characters are or anything, but I just, I don't know, I appreciated that it was playing the fairy tale thing straight while just getting the tone right, and it was really engrossing. Like, you just kind of wanted to, I don't know, I wanted to enjoy this fairy tale and just sort of have my, like, childhood innocence pandered to for a while, and in a beautiful way. It wasn't like this, it doesn't feel twee or treacly or tiny. It feels like when you're five and you're watching, like, a big Disney movie or something like that. It feels, I don't know, thick with meaning and emotion. It doesn't feel like, here's a dumb thing for your kids or whatever. So I, even though it is more simple and archetypal and family-friendly in the first half, I don't know, it didn't bother me. I didn't think, oh, this is boring. I was really entranced by it. I thought it was, like, just really pretty and nice and well thought out, you know?
Right. And I'm curious, like, so what did you think the show was trying to say in the early going? Because this is all sort of pregnant with metaphor, right? Thematically, what do you think was happening, well, really, in the first half of the show? And I kind of want to dig into this because we're talking a lot about generalizations here and, like, well, here's sort of the basic structure of the story. But what makes this show so special? Like, why is it what everyone insists that it's a masterpiece? What is it saying that India has endeared it to people so much, even in this? And let's focus on the early going here.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the music is a big part of it for me. I mean, that's a big part of how I enjoy film in general. But, like, this show, like, I feel like the musical selection, I mean, it isn't all ballet. It isn't all the stuff you'd expect from a show like this. And a lot of it very closely ties into what the show is trying to say about, you know, the metafictional stuff. And sort of the changing your fate type of stuff. It chooses a lot of music that has a lot of meaning in those ways. So that was something that immediately appealed to me. And also just that it used a lot of music that I really like.
Well, like, what's an example of, like, music that was particularly, like, well thought out on a metatextual?
Yeah, and for those of us, you know, read just about everyone listening, we're not going to understand why that piece of music is significant. So, just pick an example. Like, here's a song that meant something in the scene and added context if you were familiar with the song.
Okay, so one of the pieces it uses frequently, like, it has, like, 15 movements, and Princess Tutu uses, like, 14 of them, is Pictures at an Exhibition by Mussorgsky, which seems like kind of an unusual choice, but the point of that piece is sort of that it's about these different paintings, and the person who's at the exhibit is sort of going in and out of the painting. So it sort of fits with that idea of sort of, like, fiction coming to life and there being this blurry line between the story and reality.
Right. Okay. So sort of underlining the basic themes.
Yeah.
Rather than, it sounds like maybe that's not really giving it new context or new meaning, but it's more punctuation.
Well, there's some other ones I could pick. Like, it chooses Scheherazade by Rimsky-Korsakov, which is, of course, illustrates the story of Scheherazade and how she, you know, saves her life by telling stories. So I think there's several of them that they use.
It sort of underlines
the ideas, but it made it seem really thoughtful to me that they had put so much thought into music, even music that wasn't a ballet, because neither of those are ballets. And it's sort of, I don't know, it made it felt like they took it more seriously.
Well, I was thinking of, I know one of the ones that struck me the first time I watched it very early on was when we first see Rue and hanging out with the prince. Because, so she's trying to make her love him. And she's trying to make him love her. And you'll have to tell me the name of the piece because I don't remember it, but it is the from the Carnival of the Animals. It's the aquarium theme.
It's the aquarium.
Okay, the aquarium from Carnival of the Animals. And that piece is sort of supposed to, a lot of people hear it and think it sounds like the overture from Beauty and the Beast, and it does.
Yeah.
So if you're thinking of the overture from Beauty and the Beast, that's what it sounds like. And it's this piece that sort of denotes this it's mystery, but it's also this, like, distance from reality.
Yeah.
It's like this separation.
Because it's supposed to, like, sorry.
Oh, yeah.
It's supposed to be, like, you know, the glass and the water of the aquarium. That's why it sounds distant. And I always thought, like, the role that has in the first season sort of projects sort of a distance from, you know, the story, but it gets replaced by stuff later on in the second season that I think suggests they're more immersed in it, I guess.
More engaged. And so when we first see the prince and we hear that, it's like, oh, it's pretty. It's pretty sounding and it's beautiful and it makes him sound mysterious. But it also connotates that he is, like, completely separated from his true self. So when he's hanging out with Rue and the aquarium is playing, it's like, oh, he's not in this. Like, he's not invested. Like, the pieces that he plays with Rue later are filled with some kind of resentment. Like, first it's hatred, and then eventually love and stuff like that. But at first, it's just this twoodly, 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 you know, like, oh, you want me to love you? Okay, I'll say it, I guess. I don't really understand that emotion, but I'll say it for you. And stuff like that, where it's just like, oh, this is a really, really good choice, you know?
Yeah, they use Siegfried's death from Goethe Dämmerung by Wagner in the second season as the piece for that. Which, of course, you know, his name ends up being Siegfried.
Right,
and
now the prince's name is actually Siegfried. So.
Yeah, and I think people see that as a Swan Lake reference, which it partly is. Mm-hmm. But the person he is as a prince, like, the Prince Siegfried in Swan Lake is kind of a jerk who sort of takes advantage of the girls in the story. Like, the Prince Siegfried in, or he's not a prince, but Siegfried in The Ring Cycle is much more of a, like, honorable prince, but he's naive and he gets taken advantage of by the evil characters in the story, and that's what leads to his death. Mm-hmm. So to me, that feels like a much better fit to Muto than the Swan Lake Siegfried.
Well, he's both, really, because the Raven version of him is the Swan Lake Siegfried, and the Ring Cycle Siegfried is the character as written, which is this naive, giving, you know.
Mm-hmm. And that's who he is when he gets his heart back completely at the end.
So, yeah, like, there's a layer of references here, certainly, that adds to your appreciation if you're an adult watching rather than a child, which, you know, a lot of the simple narrative stuff is emotionally accessible to families and children, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the first season concludes, it could be a series conclusion. I don't know that it necessarily completely functions as one, but I think it was kind of obvious that they certainly thought maybe that would be it.
Right. They didn't know if maybe they were
if they were going to get more. So what happens at the end of the first season? Because this is a very clear break. Rose, can you run that down?
So basically, they all try to play out the story as it happens in the Drosselmeyer fairy tale, but it doesn't. You know, nobody dies, but Muto gets. The heart shard for love back, but Rue Crahy has dipped it in the raven's blood. So now they don't quite make this clear until the beginning of the second season, but you know, he's kind of turned evil from that.
Right. And then for the second season, which was aired in 15-minute like half episode chunks, and then turned into 13 regular episodes later.
Given like the way they play out, I think it was like the way they were written
as single episodes and split up, but there's a clear delineation because the midway point of any episode in season two concludes.
A little firm,
it's like, oh, what will happen next time? Commercial break.
Yeah.
You know, and you're like, okay. And so the first like third of season two, maybe a little bit more than that, is evil Muto, who's now a heart stopping bad boy. Who goes around he's doing the Sailor Moon S thing where he's going around trying to collect heart shards from naive girls.
Specifically, I think their entire heart. He's trying to get to the raven.
Well, he's getting his heart shard back by collecting a sacrifice.
Well, the raven wants a pure heart from somebody.
Yeah, right.
And so he's going around tricking girls, and then eventually a boy.
The other thing,
that's kind of the turning point.
The one thing, the thing that Princess Tutu likes to do more than ladle on opera, ballet, and literature references is explain its own dream logic fairy tale rules to you over and over and over again.
Yeah, well, it's aimed
like that dialogue dominates the show. You spend most of your time learning about what the shards are supposed to do, when, to whom, and why, and all of that stuff changes multiple times throughout the show. So I spent a lot of the show's runtime just trying to keep the rules straight. Mm-hmm. Where they're like, 'cause this episode is like, well, what's going to happen when he gets all this? Well, previously, he was supposed to kill the raven that comes out at the end. But now he'll be evil and give it, sacrifice himself or someone else to the raven or something.
Right,
and like,
they got raven's blood.
It changes. Yeah, yeah, and it changes just enough times to throw me off and make me feel like here I am, keep, because the show repeats these rules and then changes them so much and then has to spend so much of its time explaining shit to you. It feels like there's a lot of it. And all I'm doing is sitting here listening to fairy tale rules while meanwhile, the emotional story that's happening was fairly simple and is kind of playing out in front of you a little in slow motion because of all this fairy tale stuff that's kind of on top of it.
Right. It's very, I think in order to, I don't think they would have to explain the fairy tale rules as hard as they do and to make sure you know exactly why things are happening in what order and whatnot. If it wasn't aimed at sort of a family audience, if it wasn't like, oh, this is supposed to be family friendly. But because it is, they need to make very plain, like, it can't be like Utena where it's sort of vague and like, and aimed at like bubble pipers. Like, it can't be that. It has to be accessible for, wide audiences. So they are like pointedly telling you, okay, this is why, he can't get all his heart pieces back because the raven will come back. And this is why, you know, he turns evil this way and that way, you know, all this stuff. Like, and here's why the story is continuing to write itself. And here's why they can't just stop Drosselmeyer's ghost from writing, etc. Like, all that stuff. But I think that's fine. To me, it was still okay. It didn't feel like people just talking because at no point is anyone expositing without some emotion. And every time they're expositing, the character is expressing how they feel about the thing or what this means to them specifically. Like, every time Rue is explaining the rules behind when, how her dad is going to come back and if the prince is going to fall in love with her or whatever and what conditions have to be met before that can happen, she's explaining how she feels about that and if she, like, really deserves to be loved or, you know, or if she can trust anybody. All that stuff is tied up. So it's never just... The show is, like, sort of highly emotional all the time, so it's never just people explaining things to you.
I guess
that was... Sorry.
No, go ahead, Rose.
Yeah, that was why, like, I usually don't like the sort of lore-spouting stuff in fantasy either, but it was believable to me because it felt like the characters were usually figuring this out while they were talking about it. Like, that was... Like, there's a huge chunk of season two where Fakir and Duck are sort of investigating everything. And so it felt believable to me because it felt like this was how the characters would talk about it while they're figuring it out. It doesn't feel like it's just plopped in and totally unbelievable dialogue.
Right. Yeah, I guess I disagree with that. I guess it felt like it was mostly just exposition and rules explaining. And if they had made the fairy tale stuff less needlessly complicated, it wouldn't have been that way. Like, you said, like, well, they have to explain all this shit over and over again because the show's for kids. But the thing is, like, Utena had a bunch of apocryphal fairy tale crap in it, too, that they never really explained. Mm-hmm. But there wasn't that much of it. Like, there was sort of window dressing of that stuff. This show is singularly obsessed with it to the point where we spend entire episodes. Like, there's a whole episode where you are learning about... Fakir's Drosselmeyer powers in the second episode, and all of it involves the stuff where he's going to turn into a tree, or if he fails, he turns into a tree, and he has to like commune with this oak tree, and he shows up, and the guy's like, "Well, the oak tree's not here; it's underground. You have to look at one of these rocks for some reason.
Yeah.
Then that will make you part of the tree." And you're like, "Why did you make this so fucking complicated? This is supposed to just be like a fairy tale, but it seemed to me like." It felt to me like the script was like a bunch of people got really excited about let's play around in the world of opera and ballet, the kinds of fairy tales that get told, you know, like the Ring cycle and stuff like you were talking about. Play around in those kinds of stories and with those stories and with the symbols and semiotics that make them famous. And they just got a little too excited about it and crammed way too much of it in. And so ultimately I was left a little cold because I cared about the characters to an extent, and they're very archetypal, and I cared about what was happening to them, but their story was moving at a very slow pace because I had to sit and listen to rules of the fairy tale for forever.
But all that stuff, to me, all that stuff, I liked it because it was really neat. It's never, so the stuff with the tree, like, it's not people standing around talking about this tree. It's this wacky sequence where where Fakir gets swallowed up by a tree growing out of the ground. And then it, like, once he goes into it, he hears the voice of Adol, who we haven't mentioned yet. But Adol is this puppet who, he's literally a puppet, like a wooden puppet with strings, who appears in the town and gives advice to the other characters. And she's supposed to represent Drosselmeyer's authorial voice without it coming from him and creeping everybody out because they know that the guy who's writing their story is talking to them. So she's a proxy for him. But the problem is that she grows a heart, like she grows attached to the characters because she is a character in one of his stories. And so the oak tree is sort of equal parts like Drosselmeyer's influence and Adol's influence, which is to say, like, it's sort of the authorial powers are threatening to swallow Fakir because he is a character in the story, but at the same time, like, there is like hope there. I don't know. It's interesting.
That kind of proves my point, because it just took you like 3 minutes to get around to explain all of the moving pieces and rules for one tiny little slice, several minutes of the entire show.
That's not necessary to understanding what's happening in the scene. It makes the scene meaningful. This is layered with subtext. You don't have to understand it. Yeah. You don't have to follow that aspect of it. But it's still meaningful.
The reason I'm talking about it is because when I watched the show, I liked it, but I didn't love it. And everybody told me that I was absolutely going to love this start to finish and think it was a masterpiece. I didn't go into it with like spite or thinking like they oversold me on it. But at the end of it, I felt strangely empty and was like, well, what was it about that that didn't grab me? And ultimately, I feel like that's the storytelling roadblock, the speed bump that I'm hitting is all that stuff. And a large part of it is because so much of it is rooted in references to ballets and operas and plays that I've never fucking seen and was never into that stuff in school. Like, you know, you mentioned like Scheherazade. I don't know the story of Scheherazade. I don't. I never was taught it. It was never part of my curriculum in school, and that's not something I sought out afterward. I don't know the story of Giselle. I don't know the story of the Ring Cycle. I don't know any of that shit. And when you have the show basically centering plot points around references to these things, you're hitting a level of abstraction that takes me, someone who's unfamiliar with the references in it, or at least only vaguely so, takes me right out of it. Because what you're doing is you're presenting me a series of plot developments. The characters are doing things and moving the story forward that are abstractions pulled from plays I've never seen.
Okay, well let's flip this back around a little bit.
Yeah.
And talk about like, okay, what works that's not that? Because like you're talking about the stuff as if it dominates the narrative, and I don't think it does at all. Like,
yeah, I think I've met a lot of people who don't. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
I've met a lot of people who aren't familiar with any of that stuff, who are really into Princess Tutu. It's such a big part of why I like it.
The reason that I'm talking about it is because I feel like that is the chief reason most people have told me they like Princess Tutu. I'm not sure I've met very many people who knew nothing about any of that stuff and literally like they weren't into it, and then they really clung to this show like they really liked it. I'm just trying to sort of narrow it down to a point here.
Okay, well, we haven't talked about the thing that, so ignoring references, which there are some, but they are not necessarily necessary to understanding the story, ignoring all that stuff and talking about just the characters on a very basic level, we haven't talked about what makes the second season so subversive or takes the archetypal stuff and makes it powerful. So to me, I think ignoring all the references and stuff like that, the reason that the story really grabs a lot of people is this willingness to flesh out the archetypes that we meet in the first season. Basically taking these characters and letting them explore their own like identity within the story and saying like, okay, well, what if, so Fakir, we mentioned the Drosselmeyer powers thing. Fakir finds out that he is, technically supposed to, according to Drosselmeyer, fulfill the role of the knight who gets sliced in half in the new story, but that's not who he was originally. Like, So in the world before Drosselmeyer's stories sort of convinced everybody that they were supposed to play a specific role, he was actually Drosselmeyer's descendant. He was supposed to be the next story writer. He had the power to bring stories to life and stuff like that. But Drosselmeyer didn't really want that, so he wrote him into the story as a knight because he's trying to distract him from taking on this role. Largely because Fakir's greatest instinct, like his driving influence, is he wants to protect people. So he wants to write happy stories with happy endings, full of hope and like good things. And Drosselmeyer's a Trahedian, and he doesn't want that. So just watching the second half of Fakir putting down the sword and picking up the pen, so to speak, like that's literally the metaphor they're going with, was mm-hmm. really inspiring, and it was really heartening to see this character kind of trying to learn who he's supposed to be. And it's not just a simple like flip of a switch, because at first, when he's trying to learn how to become a writer, the person who decides to take him under his wing, who's this nerdlinger named Autor, who mm-hmm. kind of fills the role of like obsessed nerd, like nerd who is obsessed with like narrative process and lore details and stuff like that, and everybody finds him annoying, and he's that okay. character. And he's trying to teach Fakir, like, how to be Drosselmeyer. And Fakir realizes that he can't be Drosselmeyer and he can't write The Prince and the Raven. Like, he can't write that story. So he writes a story about Duck, about Princess Tutu instead. And she becomes the protagonist. And that's just a really nice sentiment. And that's just one of, like, the four different characters that have these elaborate transformations over the course of the second season. So that is a standalone thing. That all by itself is its own, like, powerful little story that anybody can understand, regardless of, like, references or whatever, you know?
Yeah, I got the basic emotional through lines. Mm-hmm. I got that stuff. Mm-hmm. I just felt like it was sort of partially obscured beneath a layer of references. It would be like if you didn't know anything about, like, Breaking Bad, and you watched a show that chiefly took its influence from that and did a lot of referencing to it. And so you're watching sort of an interesting emotional narrative play out beneath all of these layers of references. So I just felt like I was missing something the entire time. Mm. Like, I never felt like I was fully connecting with it because I don't know that ballet, you know? Like, and so I felt a little removed. I felt like there was enough of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And the story felt... occasionally, the way the plot, and I'm talking about like simple, the fairy tale plot imagination we've been talking about this whole time, that stuff just felt abstracted to the point where it just sort of came out of nowhere. Like, I understand this is supposed to be fairy tale dream logic, but like the really simple stories, there's not that much what the fuck coming at you at all times. There's no, like, there's not, like, a what-the-fuck rule change every episode.
I mean, like, I found it refreshing that it was willing to engage with the audience and keep them on their toes. So, yeah. What do you think mm-hmm. it was?
Well, we were talking about Fakir and Autor. I really, all that dialogue explaining stuff between the two of them, I found really believable because Autor was the one doing it. Like, he was a character I actually really liked because he felt like such a sort of parody of sort of like the sort of fanboy who, you know, just wants to emulate this thing that they like and doesn't want to, you know, sort of take things in their own direction. Mm-hmm. So I found a lot of that believable because it seems to be actually just skewering that attitude. But the other character besides Fakir who really sort of got to me was Rue. Her story, because she's forced into this role of the bad girl, but she really just wants to be loved. And that's why she's so obsessive, is that she's never had anyone in her life care about her before. I found that really emotionally wrenching. And I think, you know, there's a lot of references in there, but I mean, I've seen a lot of people who get into this, who I don't suspect know very much about opera or ballet. I think those core character arcs that are very archetypal can reach to them even if they don't necessarily know. I mean, they explain some of the references too, like in the episode about Coppelia, they basically tell you, oh, this was a girl who turned into a doll sort of thing, mm-hmm. or whatever it was.
I'm yeah, they open the ballet. Show with a reference riddle. Mm-hmm. They open the show with, oh, here's a weird story. Will that relate to today's episode? And you're like,
you are being unfair.
All right.
Like, yeah. The beginning of every episode, there is a charming 30-second.
It's a reference
second.
Riddle.
No, it is a charming 30-second interlude where they say once upon a time and they tell you an abbreviated version of either a famous tale or sometimes just like a small, like, generic prince versus princess dichotomy. And oh, that, you know, that's another thing that's really nice about the show is that they use side characters and like comedic characters. Like we mentioned, Adel. There's also a character named Mr. Cat who is
cameo.
A literal cat, and he's well. It's they live in a fairy tale world, so there's a lot of anthropomorphic animals. But I don't like Disney animals. I mean, they look eerily like realistic-ish.
Anteaterina.
Anteaterina, which is a giant anteater wearing a bow, and Armadillon is my favorite of the of the made-up names for these critters. But, you know, they kind of have that weird, like, old illustration that's a little too detailed and animal-like sort of thing going on. And Mr. Cat is one of these characters, and then there's a PK and Lillie, who are these two weird sadistic schoolgirls, and all of these characters that they could just throw in there and not mean anything are used in each episode to illustrate like how people are reacting to these archetypal stories or ideas. And that's neat. Like it's neat that they have scenes where they'll say something and it's just like, it's a bit about Mr. Cat wanting to marry somebody because Mr. Cat's entire raison d'etre is he wants to get married to somebody. He doesn't even seem to care who he just wants to get married. And so they'll use that, which is a stupid throwaway joke, to illustrate how people are feeling about something else. And so it's nice. It's thoughtful. It's just a very thoughtful show that engages with you at all times about how all the characters are feeling about their circumstances, which is interesting. Like, you know, the show doesn't play down or talk down or really waste any time at any point. It's throwing a little too many twists occasionally, but like it doesn't ever stop like trying to do things, I guess.
Yeah, like the one who comes to mind, not an animal character, but who is sort of a goofy joke who ended up meaning something, was Femio.
Mm-hmm.
Because he actually ended up playing a really pivotal role, especially in Rue's development, as did Autor, who was mostly there for Fakir. But, you know, he told Rue that he thought she was really pretty and he was in love with her. And that sort of shocked her into being, oh, I am someone who can be loved, even though it's totally dropped later. But it's an important sort of turning point for her as a character.
Yeah, they don't really waste anybody. It's just a really nice, thoughtful way to go about a show like this. Comparing to, say, a standard magical girl type show, like a Precure or a Sailor Moon or something like that, where a lot of the time they'll just have interludes where it's just this character eats a lot or this character's angry or, you know, something like that. And
you
have a central, like, villain to fight that may or may not have a theme, and that theme is as simple as, you know, vanity is bad, and Princess Tutu isn't like that. It's about more complicated things. You can read a lot of different, like, you can project a lot of different, whatever you're going through or whatever you remember thinking about or going through as a child, you can project that into these fantasy situations, which is why people would call it, like, Utena Jr., because one of Utena's greatest strengths was that you can read a lot into whatever is happening in any given episode based on your personal experience, because it's talking about very universal emotions. And so Princess Tutu is like that, but it's more accessible to like a family audience. So
yeah,
it felt kind of like the anime equivalent of like one of those old like 80s VHS kind of kids, like high-minded kids things. You know, maybe it would have been like an animated like Swan Lake or something. Kind of reminded me of that. Does that make sense?
Sort of
a literate thing for literate kids. Does that
like read all about it? I don't know.
Yeah, kind of, maybe a little bit, but more like PBS, you have like sophisticated parents who are patrons of the arts. This is what they give their children to enjoy. Yeah. That's the vibe I got from it. Like high quality, high end. Smart, literate kid stuff. That's kind of what it felt like.
And like this isn't even necessarily a super deep thing, but just an example of this is a fairy tale archetypal thing, but they thought about it. The they get pieces of the prince's heart. It isn't just a fetch quest thing. They think really hard about what specific emotions they are giving the prince in what order and what that will make him do in future episodes. Like when he gets fear back, up to that point, he has, sorrow. Not good emotions.
He has loneliness and sorrow.
Sorrow and loneliness and bad things like that. And then he gets fear. And fear, sorrow and loneliness are sort of inert emotions. They're not going to cause him to change his behavior very much. They maybe question things a little bit. But fear is an emotion that causes him to act, you know. And so that that shakes things up a lot. And when he has, obviously, love is a big turning point because the love gets soaked in the raven's blood before they give it back to him. So his feelings of love turn into selfish feelings instead of selfless ones, and he starts turning into a raven. And, you know, all that stuff is just, I don't know, it's just thoughtful. And the thing that gets him to fight back, because he's just turning evil and not really resisting it very much, is he gets his sense of pride back. And that's interesting, because it's like, mm-hmm. He's fighting back because of his sense of pride of who he is. But once pride starts to get, the idea is the more his heart pumps, the more the blood moves through the other pieces. And so once the raven's blood touches pride, it becomes a problem rather than a help. Like, it becomes a hindrance rather than a help, because mm-hmm. now he doesn't really know who he's fighting for. It's interesting. Like, all this stuff is just really thoughtful. And the prince is, like, the most throwaway character of the four. He's the most, like, okay, he's a damsel for other people to react to and to act for. But he's still really interesting. I don't know. It's just thoughtful.
Okay. Okay, that highlighted something that I think this highlights maybe what my major issue is. And I want to stress, I thought this was a really good show. It's just that I feel like I'm sort of presenting an alternate take here.
You're trying to, like, figure out why it didn't. Well, it didn't. Others.
But I think
I
think that touches on it, because it felt like, to me, I like all that fairy tale stuff. I like it when the fairy tale stuff gets really strange and, in general, I like that sort of thing. The problem is that Princess Tutu, for me, really felt like too much of it. So you'd have an idea like that, which is really good and really well executed. It's dogpiled on top of, like, three or four other ones that maybe happened in the 10 minutes that took place in.
Yeah.
Like, a lot. And so when you have this one really cool, mind-blowing fairy tale idea, and I'm like, well, that was neat, and then you put it, like, maybe not as good, and then maybe one that's not great, and then one that's also kind of good. Like, you're just stacking them up to the point where there's so many of them that I feel like it's hard to get my head around the whole thing, and I kind of throw my hands up a little bit mm-hmm. because I feel like I can't get my arms around whatever this thing is. They keep adding shit to it.
Right.
Like, let me just appreciate what you're trying to say in this moment before you give me five new fairy tale concepts with which I am supposed to filter through all of your characters and figure out maybe what they're supposed to mean metaphorically.
Maybe it would have been better, like, week to week.
Sorry.
It's entirely possible that the show works better as a week to week than something you binge watch.
What were we saying, Rose?
For me, yeah, I got a lot more out of it on a rewatch because I've now rewatched it, like, two or three times.
Okay, I could see that, though. I feel like I would be the same way. Like, if I watched it again, I'd be like, oh, okay. Because now I have the whole roadmap. So yeah. I won't be caught, like, off guard by the sudden absurd fairy tale rules. Like, I'll already know it. Maybe you're right. Maybe I'll watch it again.
Yeah, like the sort of disconnectedness of the first season and the way it's such a slow build. I got a lot more out of that on rewatch when I could sort of see how they were building up to stuff that happens in the second season. Like, one of the things that really struck me was sort of how they do the switcheroo with love interests in the second season.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you think that Muto and Duck are going to end up together, and then it's Fakir and Duck. Like, one of the things they show you early on is that, you know, Muto only really loves Princess Tutu, and Duck is just another girl at school. But the first time Fakir is ever nice to Duck, because he's, like, a huge jerk for about the first seven episodes to her or so, is when he sees her as a duck, as her true self. So I realized, oh, that's kind of foreshadowing what happens later on, that he ends up being the one who really falls in love with her.
Right. And likewise, as there's, so the whole theme of the second season is that these characters are realizing who they really are versus what the story or the world is telling them they're supposed to be. And, Duck realizes that she's not really, as Princess Tutu, who is this, like, graceful, selfless princess person, which, if you see Duck's personality, our heroine is, it's more Sailor Moony. It's more, oh, I'm a klutz and I'm scatterbrained and I'm goofy. And so, and it's like, oh, that's who she really is. And Princess Tutu, she transforms into Princess Tutu, but when she does, her personality changes and it's not really who she is. And she realizes the role as written for her is you confess your love to the prince and you die. And, and she's like, well, that's not really who I am. And I don't really love the prince that way. Like, as a duck, as a literal waterfowl. She just saw the prince and thought, it would be nice if he was happy. He's very...
She wanted to dance with him.
Yeah, she wanted him to be happy and to dance and smile and stuff like that. And she's like, you know, that's not really the same thing as being in love with somebody in sort of a possessive, like, I love you way. And she realizes this, and she realizes that, you know, this is not who she is, and so she's able to live on. She doesn't stick to the role of Princess Tutu. She goes back to being Duck. And the prince himself, because of this altercation with him, you know, becoming like part raven blood or whatever, he changes. He's not this internally giving but also like belonging to nobody prince. He's able to become a little bit selfish and a little bit rougher around the edges, and he realizes like, oh, I really love one person, and I'm kind of flawed, and that's okay. And the person I love is also flawed, and it's Rue, and yeah. it's like all these people are just sort of becoming more like who they're supposed to be, instead of these big tragic archetypes that are meant to be hammered down by Drosselmeyer, by the author. It's a really nice sentiment.
In a sense, it's kind of like you're watching these fairy tale characters get introduced to the concept of nuance.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's nice.
Yeah. It is nice. I really did like the end, and I the emotional through lines, although they were very simple, I did like them a lot. And the crescendos, so the magic of this show, I think, is in the crescendo of every episode.
Mm-hmm.
Because pretty much every episode has this big climactic ending, and it's similar to Sailor Moon in that there's a transformation sequence just about every time.
Mm-hmm.
But the music adds so much to the climax of every episode that you get genuinely excited and you're really into it, and it really punctuates the emotion on screen to the point where the music really makes the feelings in this show really soar. Mm-hmm. And it really grabbed me a lot. Like, it got me a lot. And that's when the show really worked on me, is when nothing mattered. Like, the references didn't matter. It didn't matter what this piece of music meant. It was incredible music underlining some really powerful emotion. And that's when the mm-hmm. show just exploded off the screen for me and really became something else. Unfortunately, I didn't do that enough, but I really did see it when it was happening. And so I get it, but ultimately I think the window dressing on Princess Tutu took it down a notch for me. I think it was just a little too much.
It was a bit.
Yeah, sorry.
No,
I'm so
ahead.
Bad at telling when people are done talking. So,
that's okay.
So I think I can oversell sometimes a little how referencey the music is. I mean, I've just overthought this so much because I've written two papers on this
sure,
show.
Sure, yeah. Understandable,
but,
right?
But I think, like, I mean, while they clearly, like, put some thought into, okay, which pieces are we going to use, how much are we going to use each of them, because stuff like Pictures at an Exhibition and Scheherazade and Carnival of the Animals keeps recurring, I feel like in the moment-to-moment uses of them, it was a lot more about emotion than it was about making a particular reference. Like, yeah. It was less, oh, we use this, you know, thing that's about this animal when this animal shows up. It was like, no, we use something that is goofy when this goofy character shows up, or something that's really tragic and stirring the emotions when something really tragic and stirring the emotions happens.
Right.
Right.
Of course, Mr. Cat's theme is the wedding march.
Yeah, that's a little more literal. The wedding... The Mendelssohn march that's used in weddings.
All right. So does anyone have like a final takeaway from Princess Tutu before we get to the Twitter questions? I feel like the show's reputation is largely earned. However, I would issue a caveat to that. If you're like me, maybe a little older, maybe you've seen like a shit ton of anime, just temper your expectations. Like, if you go into this thing expecting a B+ and it turns out to be an A+ for you, I feel like that's a better outcome than going in expecting an A+ and getting, you know, not that. And so I would just say, for those of you out there, if you've been on the fence, like all these recommendations and everything gushing about Princess Tutu for 10 years wasn't enough and you still haven't checked it out, you were on the fence, it's worth your time, I would say, but just temper those expectations, I think. What do you think, Hope?
I like Princess Tutu because it's a kind of, provided that they're okay with, like, anime, it is the kind of, like, TV show you can show, like, little girls or, you know, maybe some boys, who knows. And they will, I don't know, be really, really touched by it because it speaks to them like they're smart, speaks to them like they're not, like, you know, just sort of, I guess, items to be pandered to commercially. It's just, I don't know, it's just really meaningful, and it gives girls, like, characters that they can relate to, and And it's not an anime thing. Like, it is very accessible. There's not really anime-y stuff in it at all. Like
character designs, but yeah.
Well, ignoring the art style, but yeah, the art style.
You can't. It's...
Okay, if they're cool with the way it looks, like it is a family friendly anime that is not like dumb, and that's really nice. But ignoring that, I like that. I really do appreciate that on the perspective of like something that you can show to others, because a lot of my interest in anime is based around like, hey, this stuff is not weird or like super niche or hard to understand. Like some of it's just really unique and nice for wider audiences, but like. So I really appreciate that, but just as an adult, as a, like, this is a personal thing to me, I love the writers and the art directors and the musicians, like, love of story and understanding of, like, what makes a good story isn't the same thing as what makes a, like, a good life is a nice message to have, and being metatextual about it without, like, being punishing. They're not saying Drosselmeyer is a bad man. He's crazy. But it's not like, oh, he's evil and they have to fight against him. He's interested in drama, and that's nice, too. It was one of the things I liked about Fate Zero and a couple of other Urobuchi works is occasionally he will mention in his story, like, you have to understand I'm torturing these people because I love my audience or because I know that this will make a good story. That stuff, it's just all, that stuff is super smart and thoughtful, and I loved it. So, yeah, Princess Tutu is great. It's not like, you know, super hoity-toit for adult stuff. Anybody can watch it, but it's great. It's really good, meaningful entertainment. So,
yeah, I agree with a lot of that.
I mean, I actually agree with the sort of temper your expectations thing, especially on a first watch, because I think a lot of this for me has only built up meaning from multiple watches and sort of reading so much into it. But especially, like, people recommend this show to be everything these days. Like, I remember when I first watched it, I was kind of disappointed that it wasn't as capital F feminist as people were telling me it was going to be, because that's how people recommend everything these days that has strong female characters.
Yeah.
I mean, it can be read that way because it's all about people sort of fighting against the roles they've been given. But if you're expecting it to be an Utena or a Fujiko Mine or something like that, you're going to be disappointed.
No,
there's an old white man who controls everything.
Yeah.
It's comfort food. Like it's meaningful, but it is comfort food. It's not like super fighting the man, you know.
Yeah, it's something what I like about it is I like that it's something that can be enjoyed in a very, you know, visceral, emotional sort of way, but it also has a lot of stuff that leaves you thinking. But you don't have to engage with it on that level if you don't want to. There's a lot of different levels you can engage with Princess Tutu. Yeah.
I will say that on a lot of these rewatch shows, I hit snags sometimes and I'll like pick up a show for a while, and then if it's not really grabbing me, I'll sort of put it down for a while. Mm-hmm. This one, once I started watching it, I just blew through it. Like it mm-hmm. grabbed me pretty. I really wanted to see what would happen. Like I didn't know really how it was going to wrap up, and I wanted to see where it was going to go visually. That was kind of a letdown, unfortunately, mm-hmm. but.
You didn't like some of the conceptual visuals and like the
okay. I'm just gonna say this. This is just personal preference. I'm not slamming the show, but I don't like those Precious Moments character designs. I think they make the show. If that show looked like fucking Belladonna of Sadness or like some kind of karaoke thing, I probably would be all over it. I would probably be like, this is a masterpiece because it would be. I would want all of that imagery to be unbelievably, like, lush, like, lavish, overdone. I want it to look like Vampire Hunter D Bloodlust.
Okay.
Like, I want it to look like that. Because they're talking about stuff that is this grand, Baroque tradition. These stories are, like, etched into stone.
Yeah, it's a lot of very...
There's a lot of pomp 19th and
circumstance. 19th century romantic ideas.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't
look
like it.
Yeah, and so, right. And so I want it to look like the most elaborate stage performance ever instead of, hey kids, it's 8:30 in the morning. Let's learn about being the main character in your own story. Like that. Yeah. So the aesthetic, if this had a stronger aesthetic, I'm convinced that I would be like A+.
Yeah.
Maybe not, but the fairy tale stuff probably would still turn me off. But,
yeah, but
I wish it looked cooler. I wish it looked cool.
Well,
it doesn't.
But then
look
it
cool.
Wouldn't be like appealing to kids.
Yeah, sure. I guess. I mean, maybe it would appeal to teenagers more, but. Yeah, this is my personal preference. I'm not a child.
Absolutely. It's just I get where you're coming from. At the same time, it's like I think if they had made it that way, then they wouldn't have had a target audience really.
Absolutely. I agree with you. And I agree with you. I was just saying, like, in Zach world,
right.
Not in the real world, in Zach world, that show would look like, a very expensive production of something. Okay, we ready to take these Twitter questions?
Yeah.
Okay. But first, a word from our sponsor. Hey, folks, you know, it's that time of year. The holidays have arrived, and that means there's a Twilight Zone marathon somewhere on cable television. Yes, laughter, cheer, reuniting with your family, gift-giving, pumpkin pie, all those things you get at the holidays, along with some ironic story twists that serve as an allegory for a deeply felt humanist or otherwise unexpected message of tolerance. That's what we all come together for around Christmas time. You know, this very commercial has an ironic story twist in it. It's a heartwarming message that subverts the overwhelming consumerism of the holidays. When you think about it, really, Right Stuff is going to give you something. An online retailer is going to give you a gift. That's right. Right Stuff's giving out 100 free God Anime memberships. All you got to do is go over to stuff.it/ancast. That's stuf.it/ancast. ANNCAST. Head on over there. You give them your name and your email. And if you are among the first 100 people, the first 100 people listening to this, you get a free God Anime membership for 2016. The whole year. Now, normally that would run you like $12. And the thing comes with a nice suite of perks. You get extra discounts off of Right Stuff's already low prices. You get access to some special members-only discounts. And you get that extended 90-day period of returns. So, say like there's another ironic twist in your life, and you accidentally order a copy of Sword Art Online, and it's cursed. So, you know, it watches you. Well, you can return it, and you have 90 days to do it. You know, you didn't order any ironic comeuppance, so I don't know why they included that in the package. Anyway, head on over to rightstuff.com, where the holiday sale is still raging uncontrollably, and to stuff.it/ancast for that free God Anime membership. First 100 people, get them while they're hot, folks. Piping hot. Yep, cooking. All right. All right. Lost Thief asks, why do you think people insist on calling her a hero when calling her duck means we can call her and Fakir the fuck ship? I see we got a lot of serious questions this time.
Very serious.
So is there a lot of shipping for Princess Tutu?
Oh, yeah.
Jesus,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Why did I even ask that question?
Well, I was going to say, it's a fairy tale romantic thing aimed at girls.
It's really girly. The show, like, it's really, really girly. It's got a lot of, like, he looked at me in the beginning. And then, like, you are supposed to, the main character is like, now he's bad. He's kind of more attractive. You know, like, it's really
girly.
Well,
there's a lot of homoeroticism between Fakir.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of that, too.
So there's that, too.
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of homoeroticism involving both genders, and there's a lot of stuff that gets hinted that doesn't end up sort of, you know, resolving itself, because there seem to be a lot of people who ship, like, Muto and Duck and are upset that that doesn't happen, which to me kind of feels like missing the point of the story, but okay. No one said shippers were always the best at that.
It's aimed at starry-eyed girls is, I think, the...
Yeah.
Certainly.
Yeah, and I think it's perfect for that audience. Overlord wants to know... Is or is not Rue one of the greatest anime characters of all time?
I wouldn't.
Also, people who think the show is stupid based on its name. Opinion? Well, you just want me to say they're dumb.
Princess Tutu is a bad name. While I was watching it, I was like, why didn't they call her Princess Swine? But I guess, I don't know.
I just wouldn't, like, I don't know how sell this.
Or what's duckling in German, right? So something like that. Not Tutu.
My German isn't good enough for that. Enda is duck.
Does anyone here agree with his theory that Rue is one of the greatest anime characters of all time?
No, I like her a lot, but she kind of seems like a simpler version of what's, like, the sort of thing that's being done with a character like Anthy and Utena.
Yeah. She's not a complex... She's complex absolutely for a thing aimed at families and stuff like that, but
yeah.
She's very likable. Here's the cast of Tutu is not super complex. They are very lovable. At least I thought so. I think the cast is extremely easy to like. Even the annoying ones, like Mr. Cat and then Adel.
I love Autor, and he's supposed to be annoying.
Yeah, Adel gives up her life to protect everybody at some point, and her scraps, because she's a puppet, get made into a smaller puppet who is annoying and beats Little Drum. And I even like her, and she's annoying, mm-hmm. and her role is to act like a dumb little kid and, like, have a heart and help people. But even her, she's likable. So I just, the cast is very, very easy to love and snuggle, is, I guess, kind of the thing that makes it work.
Okay. Emperor Matt wants to know, are there any composers or pieces that the show introduced you to? I mean, Rose, that can't be true for you.
Well, actually, I didn't know as much of the stuff that's, like, purely ballet, but isn't necessarily, like, revered by classical music fanatics outside of that. Like, I knew, like, the Tchaikovsky stuff and the Prokofiev stuff, but not stuff like Coppelia and Giselle. So that was, it did introduce me to some of that stuff.
Hope?
I watched the, some of it was familiar to me, but I got my education on quite a bit of it from watching the behind the scenes on the DVDs. They have a, like, explaining the music featurettes, and those are really neat, that are just explaining to you what, where each piece came from, what it means and stuff like that. So, I actually literally didn't have to watch Princess Tutu and then research. I just watched the featurettes for the show, and they were, like, mm-hmm. educating me on stuff, and I thought it was really interesting. So, yeah.
Yeah, I would be interested in watching a version of this that just had, like, pop-up, like, here's what this means, here's what that is, this piece means that, this is from this other story, like, it's very...
I wrote a paper of explaining a bunch of it, if you want me to link it to you.
Sure, that sounds great. Okay, Zader Nova asks... Is it still the best children's anime ever made, bar none? I can't judge that. I don't think I've seen enough children's anime.
It's the best one I've seen. But that's just me.
That's something you could say. I couldn't say it's the best children's anime ever made.
It's the best one I've seen.
Yeah, it's my favorite. Digimon Tamers is a close one.
Does Night on the Galactic Railroad count as a children's thing?
Maybe. I mean, if you're not counting, like, Ghibli movies or whatever, like, TV shows.
Yeah.
Like, TV shows.
Yeah, it's up there.
You know, it's, I can't, I.
Actually, I don't think I can think of a better one, so yeah.
Like, yeah. The only one I've seen that is that smart, Rose mentions, is Digimon Tamers, and I think that one has tone problems where it doesn't.
Yeah, it's not.
For kids. Like, Princess Tutu is never too much for its audience. It knows its audience really well. Digimon Tamers is, like, half appropriate for kids and half, like, oh, this does not belong in here. So, yeah, I don't know.
Like, Princess Tutu never really gets that scary, which I think is something you have to worry about if you're making it for kids, where it was like, there are parts of Digimon Tamers where if I had watched it when I was the right age, I would have just shut it off and ran into another room.
Yeah, no, I did. It scared the piss out of me. So, yeah, Princess Tutu never has that problem. It is just dark enough that audience, like, likes it. Like, it's the mm-hmm. scary level that little girls, like.
Yeah.
Not, you know, any more than that.
Yeah. All right. NobleKind92 asks, how do you sell this show to someone who has no interest in ballet?
Yeah, I don't think you need to be that into ballet. I mean, I'm, even for a classical music person, I'm not that into ballet. My thing is opera.
A healthy interest in one of those things is recommended. If you really, like,
yeah,
I would recommend
adds
it.
A lot to
Let
the
me
show.
Put it to you this way: you make this exact same show, but you load it up with references to art, and I am there. It's just not my. It's just not my ballet and opera and stuff, like folklore. It's not my particular, you know, chosen field. Like, you kind of have to be into that stuff,
yeah,
right?
I don't know shit about ballet or opera, classical music and stuff somewhat, but I don't know shit about ballet or opera. The thing that was meaningful to me about Princess Tutu was the folklore angle. Like, I'm a big study of narrative and legend and folklore and stuff like that, and fairy tales.
Mm-hmm.
And if you like the, like, origins of fairy tales, you will dig the shit out of Princess
Tutu. Yeah.
Well, it's embarrassing for me to say, like, look, I don't fucking know the story of Scheherazade, but I was never taught it anywhere, and
it's
folklore
the
wasn't
for Aladdin.
Yeah, right. It's just my area of study and interest was not necessarily that stuff. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. it's easy to say, like, oh, everyone knows the ring cycle. No, they don't. No,
I don't expect
don't.
Most people know the ring cycle. You know? Most people, when I tell them I study Wagner, like, oh, he was the guy Hitler liked. I'm like, yeah, and...
Yes, yes.
At Hitler, he's everywhere these days. All right. Redcar728 asks, Theron once gave Tutu's music a rare A+, saying on an Ancast it was because the music became the story. Agree, disagree, thoughts? I mean...
I agree.
I think an A+ for music in Princess Tutu is almost cheating. Well, they didn't compose that stuff.
You know.
Yeah, but I feel like they deserve credit for how they selected it.
Well, that's like a good wine pairing. It's not like you didn't compose the music. That's just a really good pairing.
Yeah,
and then you have to kind of give like a grade for the music, regardless of whether it was original or stuff. And I mean, like, I feel like using music well in a film isn't entirely about just writing it. It's a lot about how they put it in there.
Sure. Let me put it to you this way. This to me is kind of like saying, man, the soundtrack to Fantasia. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we know. It's good music. Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, like, on one level, yeah, of course, compulsory A+. But on another level, yeah, like, I've heard classical music get slapped into anime really poorly and movies a dozen times. You know, like, it can be done very easily. This could have been the hackiest thing to ever hack. So it is thoughtfully done. And, like, even
it deserves credit for that, I think.
Music. Yeah, it doesn't even have to be classical music. You can tell when, like, a newly composed score is used poorly in a thing. My favorite go-to for this for anime is Helsing. Not Ultimate, but the original Helsing has a really interesting, eclectic, like, fun, could-have-been-used-great score. And the way it's used in the show is garbage. It's just like, it always sounds like there's a radio on in the background playing random songs that have nothing to do with what's going on screen.
Or like, you brought up Digimon. There's a big difference between how the dub of Tamers uses pretty much the same soundtrack with the dub of the previous two seasons.
Yeah, exactly. Which is this overblown, like, way over-orchestrated...
Yeah, it's just constantly playing.
...thing, but in Tamers, they had a different team working on it, and it is... Occasionally, it goes silent, and there's tone differences and stuff like that, and it's not just this continually blaring thing. So, yeah, I mean, there's nuance there.
All right. Heroic Type asks, what influenced Tutu's success or lack thereof, and would a reboot work better in today's magical girl deconstruction-friendly climate?
No.
Don't reboot it.
It's so good already.
See, I think it would be fine.
I think it would be fine.
I think you could reboot this now and maybe age it up a little bit, and it would probably do really well.
Aim it at adults and rewrite it. Yeah, I would be interested in seeing that, but I don't think it can cover up for the original. The original is its own thing.
Totally.
I would agree with Zach's issue with the visual aesthetics. Like, I would like to see a reboot that sort of did it in a,
more adult.
Did it in a more grown-up sort of artistic way that sort of fit more with the, 19th century romantic music and fairy tales that they're referencing. Yeah. But other than that, I don't know if I'd want a reboot because I already think it's so good. But I got into it because I was into Modica, and I've seen a lot of people successfully recommend it based on its similarities to stuff like that.
Right.
So I definitely think that, if they did a re-release or reboot of it in this environment, it would do a lot better.
I think if I had seen this before Madoka or Utena, I would have thought it was groundbreaking, mind-blowing, the most amazing thing.
Right.
I feel like I've seen what this show is doing done more to my taste too many times in order to be really blown away by this.
Yeah, I see. I can do the
That's where the music's a big part of it for me, because I'm like, yeah, I love Madoka, I love Utena, and they certainly have great music, but they don't do it with this music I'm already in love with and reference it and stuff. So
yeah, this is one of those made especially for you,
right?
Yeah,
in a sense. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah, I totally get it.
Depends on what part of my brain I'm playing with, because if it's I'm in the mood for a more adult deconstruction or whatever, then that's fine. Or if I'm just in the mood for cake that I don't feel is garbage, this is cake, but it's good, upper crust cake, and it's not I don't necessarily want to feel all huffy puff about stuff all the time. Sometimes I just want nice.
This is this is fancy bejeweled wedding cake.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I definitely rewatch this show a lot more than I rewatch Madoka and Utena, even though I think I like those. I might like those a little bit. I don't know about Madoka, but I like Utena a little bit more than Princess Tutu. Mm-hmm. Just because it's easier to just, rewatch when I'm kind of feeling down.
Yeah, definitely.
It's more emotionally satisfying. Those are more, I guess, intellectually satisfying.
Yeah, what anime did I rewatch the most this year? Well, it was JoJo's. I loved Yurikuma, but I'm not going to immediately rewatch Yurikuma Arashi.
It's this one or Oran, or maybe some of the more comedic episodes of FMA or something, or Cowboy Bebop. Those are the shows I rewatch the most, not necessarily the most, not Utena.
Yeah, it goes down easy. Utena does not go down easy. It's an engaged sit, and it's sometimes emotionally exhausting. Princess Tutu just makes you feel good.
Yeah.
All right. Trillane 22 asks, best use of a meta story in anime? Why did it excel so well? Was it the execution, the novelty? What was it?
Best. I think it really committed to the meta story thing.
It did.
I'm trying to think of another example of something that commits to a meta story, and that's the point of it, as hard as Princess Tutu does, and there aren't a lot of them. What's another one?
I can't think of any off the top of my head. Just because I can't think of any, the meta story is the point of the show, so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right, NeoCloud9 asks, considering the show's troubled history in reaching an audience, how would you have chosen to market it? I mean, ADV tried to sell this to the Hot Topic crowd. They tried really hard. Mm-hmm. It didn't go. It didn't take. I think the look of the show, it's like One Piece. Mm-hmm. It's just a turn off to Western audiences, maybe a little too much, to the point where it will find an audience, but that audience will be niche. Like, just on aesthetics. And that kind of sucks.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Ruth.
Sorry, I'm so bad at this.
Okay.
I do think it would have an easier time getting an audience now because there's so much of a particular audience specifically for sort of subversive magical girl stuff. Like, enough that we get, like, another one of those every year, even if it's not really all that subversive, but it tries to be. Like, so I think now they would have a ready-made audience to market it to.
Yeah, which is why, I think if they aged it up just a little bit and rebooted it, you'd do real well.
Well, I think that's why you mentioned that the cult audience for it is bigger than it once was, and I agree with that. Like, when I first heard about it in 2009, the fervor for it was smaller than it is now. More people have seen the show now. And I think that's because the climate for it was right, and people were reaching back into the past and going, oh, this thing.
Yeah.
And, as far as, like, how to market it, one of the most, like, well-known AMVs, like, even if you're not, like, a weird, like, okay, the weird is the wrong word. If you're not super into AMVs and you know, like, what's the newest ones, one of the most got-around AMVs is a Princess Tutu one, and that kind of showed how to market that show. Like, hey, that's the thing that got everybody to watch it. Like, associations with Madoka and that AMV are the number one and two reasons people have told me that they watch that show. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. Like, just that was the tone, which was what was that, like, Swedish pop song set to,
yeah, Swedish or Norwegian or something, I don't know.
Yeah, it's Swedish power pop set to emotional highs of the show. That's how you market it, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I have Mind Half Full asks, if you had to be a sentient animal like there are in Princess Tutu, what animal would you be?
That's hard. There's already a cat in it.
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't mean you can't be. You can be whatever you want.
But he'd probably want to marry me. I don't know if I'd want to marry
exactly.
Mr. Cat.
Like that was what my thought was. It's like, you have to avoid Mr. Cat.
I'm going to go with Pomeranian.
Right. There was a Chihuahua in one of them. I don't know.
Be a grackle.
I can't think of a specific one. I'm just
I can't be a blackbird. There are already too many crows and ravens that like mean stuff. I can't do that.
Right. Well, you want to pick a bird. So you want to pick a bird so you can fly. That's the easy. That's the easy choice. But mostly, I just like looking at the designs. Like, there's so many weird ones. And so I'm about to blow the minds of everybody who liked both Yurikuma and Princess Tutu. If you recall, in Princess Tutu, there is literally a bear who gives up on love in the first season. We don't meet her. It's just this like bear who's like 30 in her 30s or 40s or something like that, and she literally gives up a gem that's called love to the feelings vendor Adel and leaves, and she's like, I don't deserve it, and it's like, oh no, is Yurikuma Arashi all over again?
It's hard because all the animals I want to be are already in it, like an anteater, an armadillo, or an alligator, and yeah, they all start with A. Start thinking outside of that letter, I guess. Yeah, they're all the animals I'd want to be are already in there.
Pomeranian.
maybe a really, chameleon.
The more I think about that, the better it sounds. I've spent this whole time I've been sitting here thinking, what would it like to have to be a Pomeranian, or like be a human person with a Pomeranian head? Like, everyone would be really nice to you. Or
they
freaked
would.
Out.
They would think you were just super, like, you could insult them to their face, and they'd be like, oh, you're so cute.
But then also no one would ever take you seriously.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
You'd be like, I'm sorry, your mother is dead. And they'd be like, oh. All right.
Terrible.
Moving on. Invalid Name asks, for Tutu Cast, how much of the Western interest in this show is attributable to that one great AMV? So, probably a lot. Yeah, you've touched on that.
Yeah.
Andrew Guraru asks, if Utena is the Evangelion of magical girl shows, Okay, we'll just go with that premise. Subverting the cliches of the genre, then Princess Tutu is the giant robo of the genre, celebrating the genre with an optimism and sincerity. Agree or disagree?
Yeah.
I don't agree with that.
I don't agree with the entire premise of that, so...
I don't think Utena is the Evangelion of magical girl shows.
Yeah, I don't like the way that he phrased it, because I don't like that sort of... Utena is the Evangelion of the blah, blah, blah. I don't like that stuff, but that sort of TV tropism. But I do agree that it's sort of the more affectionate, less challenging version of Utena.
Well, if I had to put all three of these shows, if you put Madoka, Utena, and Princess Tutu, like if I put all these three together, it would be like one of these is obviously much gentler. But I don't know that it's a celebration of the magical girl genre.
Yeah, well,
that's the problem
with that thinking is that I think neither Utena nor Princess Tutu is really about magical girl tropes the way that Madoka is.
Yeah.
Mm. Like, they're magical girl shows, but they're dealing with different stuff.
And even Urobuchi, when asked if Madoka was an intentional satire or commentary on magical girl stuff, he said, no, I just wrote what I would want to see out of that genre. He said, I wasn't necessarily, he said, there's some commentary there, but I wasn't trying to subvert it or really make that the point. He said, if that's a side note to just, this is what I want to do with this genre. So, I mean, like, yeah, none of that is like specifically, I don't even think Utena is that magical girlish. It reminds me.
No, it's just, she has a transformation sequence, but it feels like if it's commenting on anything, it's commenting more on like standard shoujo.
Yeah. Or romance stuff that's aimed at older women, like not.
Utena is a very weird show, and really putting it in a box and saying it's magical girl is really easy for people to do. And it's an easy way to recommend it to people, and it makes sense. So that's why people do it. But it's way too reductive as a label for Utena. It's just too reductive. So like, I get your point here.
I would say that one of the things that struck me is that Utena is basically saying that the idea of prince and princess is fundamentally wrong. Whereas Princess Tutu is kind of not saying that, but it's saying, well, we shouldn't force you into that though.
Yeah.
So it does feel like it's sort of Utena Jr., as people put, like similar ideas not going quite as far.
Princess Tutu just introduces the idea that storybook archetypes that you were raised with are reductive, and you shouldn't let the world tell you what kind of role you fill. Utena is like, here's the real shit. Here's what's going to happen to you when you're an adult, and it just goes very hard and very deep and very detailed into stuff. Mm-hmm. It is not just gently introducing the concept of ambiguity and there not being hard answers for societal roles. It's just like, no, it's much harsher than that. So,
yeah.
All right. Red Sub Claire asks, who would you not recommend the show to? I really liked it myself, but I can see not everyone will be on the same page. So I would say if you have seen Utena and Madoka already, Princess Tutu is not going to blow your mind, and therefore I wouldn't say make it a huge priority. But if you liked those shows, you will also like this. It's a good one of those. I don't think it's as good as those other two. And if you're older, it's definitely not going to connect with you as much as those other two.
Mm-hmm. So. Unless you have a big attachment to classical music or fairy tale stuff.
Right, which is a very important thing to point out.
Yeah, if you're not super into Disney-esque magic and wonder and feelings, you're probably not gonna jump on Princess Tutu.
But I would say also anybody who's too super allergic to girly stuff.
If they're like, my personal identity is bound up in the media that I consume, and they're like really,
No girl stuff.
Yeah. Then okay, but why are you hanging out with that guy?
Yeah, true.
Moving on. Torchica asks, were you happy with the ending? Would you have changed or added anything?
Nope, I wouldn't have.
No.
Okay, me either. I think this is like, perfect. Would you have made it more explicit that Fakir and Duck got together?
Yeah, that's the only people I see who have issues with the ending are shippers who wanted them more clearly together. And I mean, I'm really invested in their romance, but I also think it was tied together perfectly.
Yeah, I don't need to see that.
He becomes
a writer who writes hopeful, inspiring stories, and there's a duck that lives in the lake next to his house. That's all I need to know.
He said he'll stay by her side forever. What more do you need?
Yeah.
Right. Yep, being in love with a duck ain't all it's quacked up to be. Anyway, Ford DM asks, I'm having a hard time getting through this show. I've heard it gets good in the second half. Should I stick it out? I think if you really, really don't like the first half, give up. Give up.
Yeah, I didn't hate the first half. I just found it kind of boring. And I'm like, I'm one of the like least spoiler phobic people in the world. So I looked up what was going to happen. I was like, okay, that's interesting. I'll stick out for that.
All right. Okay, we're going to wrap up here with a question from Bunny Bookends. This is the ultimate question. So, if you're going to sell it under a different title, what would you have called Princess Tutu?
I would have changed your name to something that's... you have Princess Crikey, and that is German for
crow.
So, German for duckling, or not swan, because that is literally schwan. So, no.
Enda, maybe, is duck.
Yeah,
in
Princess
German.
Enda something. I don't know, just something like that.
I think it's something like that. Enta might be it. I don't know. My German isn't that great.
Yeah, but past that, I would have to think more creatively. But just minimal effort, just not tutu. Just change.
Yeah.
You could call it the gods must be crahy.
Ugh.
I don't. What's wrong with me today?
I don't know what's wrong with you today. Who even knows that movie?
You do.
Yes.
I got it.
It's my responsibility to know these things.
I probably would have given it some sort of gothy name. Give it a gothy name, maybe it would sell.
Maybe call it Princess Crahy.
I don't think you can put Princess in the name. Princess has to go.
But it's aimed at like
the movie Black Swan. Black Swan would be a great name for this. A great name for it.
No.
That would sell more copies than Princess Tutu. For sure.
If you called it like the duck and the crow,
nope.
In German.
Well, there's no. I mean, you don't want to give it a title that is.
It's Dienta, by the way, is the duck.
I think the princess should be in there because it kind of that's the audience, the people who want to see something with princess in the title.
Yeah.
Okay.
She's not. Maybe
but it's the combo.
So it's a really good show with the right title. Why didn't it sell?
Well, no, Tutu is the problem, not the princess.
It's the combination of princess and Tutu. I think it's just two ultra girly things combined that sound like they're for little girls.
I think the audience for this show kind of has to be white. Like, it's just a real marketing challenge for anime, like, in general, because it's not being sold in the children's aisle. So, I mean, I don't think it's being sold really at all. Like, you can buy it, right? There are still copies floating around?
Yeah.
It's in print on Amazon.
All right. Well, anyway, let's wrap it up there, Rose. It was an absolute pleasure having you on.
I really enjoyed it.
Your expertise added quite a lot to the show and definitely made me feel like I wasn't crazy for having the reaction that I did to it. So I really appreciate that. Anyway, that wraps us up. Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Rose for stopping by. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band New Division. You can check them out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave us a rating or a review. We'd really appreciate it. And I'll see you all next week.